Zoo Story received its premiere in Berlin on a program with Samuel Beckett's Crap's Last Tape. It was initially rejected by New York producers. Albee was unknown, and one-act plays like The Zoo Story were considered unmarketable. After its success in Germany, The Zoo Story received its American premiere in 1960, off-Broadway, at the Provincetown Playhouse. Three of his plays opened in New York within the next year, The Sandbox, Fam and Yam, and The Death of Bessie Smith. His first play to open on Broadway was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which opened in 1962 at the Billy Rose Theater and starred Uta Hagen and Arthur Hill. It won a Tony Award, an ANTA Award, Drama Critics Circle Award, and Outer Circle Award. The play offended some audiences and critics. John Chapman in the New York Sunday News called it a, quote, calculated exercise in depraved obscenity, unquote. Albee has made it clear that he doesn't mind offending audiences. He said, I don't care whether they like it or hate it, so long as they're not indifferent. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was later made into a film in 1966. Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, who were married at the time, starred as the neurotic bickering couple. Albee has won two Pulitzer Prizes, in 1967 for A Delicate Balance and in 1975 for Seascape. He's written several adaptations for the stage, including Carson McCullough's Ballad of the Sad Cafe and Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita. The American Poetry Review and American Poetry Center are presenting a reading by Edward Albee tonight at 8 o'clock in the Great Hall of the Philadelphia College of Art building on Broad and Pine Streets. He'll be holding playwriting and directing workshops tomorrow, but those workshops are already filled. The reading tonight is at 8 o'clock at the Philadelphia College of Art building on Broad and Pine Streets in their Great Hall. Edward Albee, welcome to Fresh Air, and I'm very glad that you could be here today.
I'm glad the train got in on time.
Yeah, me too.
And isn't it nice that John Chapman realized that I was calculated rather than scattershot? You know what he also said in his review?
What?
Strange man that he was. He said that Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was a play that should only be seen by dirty-minded women.
Huh.
And you know, that probably added 6 months to the Broadway run.
What a great quote. Your grandfather ran the Keith Albee vaudeville circuit.
Well, let's see. He was my grandfather because I was adopted into the family. He was my grandfather that way. And whether he ran it, he started it and owned it, and I guess he ran it.
Were you surrounded by theater people when you were growing up?
As I recall, they were mostly vaudeville people. Most of them now long dead, but I remember people like Ed Wynn coming to the house, and Billy Gaxton and people like that nobody under 106 remembers anymore.
Do you think that helped interest you in the theater?
I don't know. Since I didn't write my first play till I was 29, it would suggest that I was pretty slow to learn. It did interest me.
You also have, I know there's humor in your plays, but they're serious theater. It's not like musical comedy or vaudeville. It's not out of that.
Well, they're serious
tradition.
Plays in that the attempt of serious drama is to put people more in contact with themselves, make them more aware of what it's like to be alive. And you do that by both by humor and also by hitting people in the gut. And then if you do the two at the same time, it's nice.
What are some of the early theater performances that you saw that had that kind of effect on you?
Well, let's see. Of course, the first experience that I had, and then this must take me back to the middle 50s, the first experience I had with Beckett and Genet and Ionesco were profound experiences. Being in West Berlin in 1959 for the world premiere of The Zoo Story, going across to East Berlin and seeing my first live Brecht performance at the Berliner Ensemble Theater in East Berlin. That was a pretty moving experience. But back home, I suppose, seeing some of O'Neill's late plays, The Iceman Cometh, A Long Day's Journey Into Night, seeing some of Tennessee's plays, I suppose. And just about anything. My first experience with Chekhov, of course, didn't hurt.
Did you plan on being a writer when you were back in school?
Oh, yeah. I started writing when I was 6. I started writing poetry.
You went to Valley Forge Military Academy for about a year, which is in this area. Did you ever plan on a military career?
I got put into Valley Forge Military Academy because I kept getting thrown out of other prep schools. And there was a law on the books, I guess, then that said that your parents couldn't put you in a reform school, no matter how badly you thought you were behaving. So they put me in the next best thing, I guess.
What did you do that was so ill-behaved?
I went to those classes that I liked and didn't go to the ones that I didn't like. I didn't pay any attention to professors that I thought weren't very interesting. And the way a person should be educated, and if the world were ideal.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that people always tell you. When you grow up, you'll realize all that you missed, and you'll be sorry that you missed out on those classes and that you misbehaved. Did you ever have any regrets?
No, none whatever. And I didn't have too much educational experience at Valley Forge Military Academy, as I recall it. Courses in sadism and masochism and things like that.
You also were asked to leave, or it was suggested you didn't come back to Trinity College after a year and a half. Did you feel that your future was ruined after that?
No, I have just always found, both in school and out of school, that extracurricular activities are much more useful, valuable, and fun than anything that is prepared for you.
Edward Albee is my guest if you're just joining us. You wrote a sex farce when you were a teenager called Alequeen or Alequeen.
I'm not 13, sure 12 and a half, 13, my first play. But, you know, I can pretend that it doesn't, that my Zoo story was my first play, since Alequeen vanished. The play vanished. I think my mother threw it away.
Oh, you don't have it anymore?
Oh, no, it doesn't exist.
What was it about?
It was about a couple. I don't remember what it was about. I remember the characters were titled British and Nouveau Riche Americans, and I don't remember a damn thing about what they did.
Are you glad that you don't have it? Because I think many writers are very embarrassed by their very early efforts.
Many writers are very embarrassed by their most recent efforts, too. No, I'd sort of miss it. I'd like to see what it was about.
Someone might have discovered it and tried to publish it. Would that have made you uncomfortable?
Well, since it wasn't copyright, I guess they could go right ahead and do it.
Okay. Why did you decide to write a play at the age of 29?
Because I was a writer, and I was a lousy poet and a terrible novelist and not very good at the essay or the short story. And what else was there?
That play was the Zoo story. Mm-hmm. Could you describe that in capsule form for our listeners who haven't seen or read it?
Well, yeah. It is an hour-long confrontation in New York City Central Park between a man named Peter, who is well adjusted to his society, a middle brow, middle class, young middle-aged man, nicely married with kids, reading a book in Central Park when he is accosted by a man named Jerry, who has been variously described by critics, depending upon their bents, as A, a psychopath, or B, Jesus Christ. No critic ever getting it right that he was sort of both. And Jerry tries to impose upon Peter a sense of what it is like to be alive, to teach him, in other words, so that there's a great deal more to living than what most people seem to understand. And Peter keeps refusing to understand what's going on. And as a result, Jerry has to teach by the final example of getting himself killed.
That play was rejected by New York producers.
Well, mind you, understand, back in 1958, 59, there really was no off-Broadway. And Broadway producers weren't interested in producing an hour-long one-act play by a completely unknown American writer. They still aren't, you know, but then there was even less true.
The first production was in Berlin.
The first production was in West Berlin in German.
Oh, I
didn't
realize
that. On a double
bill
with Beckett's Crap's Last Tape. Yes, I saw my first play under the title Die Zoogeschichte.
Did you feel that your play had an affinity with Crap's Last Tape?
You know, I hadn't read Crap's Last Tape or seen it when they were done together, but I got a hold of the script, and I was delighted by the pairing, and, you know, a man that I admired so much. It was such a good play as Crap's Last Tape.
Did you get to meet Beckett then?
Oh, yes, I got to know him. Not right then, but we got to know each other afterwards. What a nice man.
Would you talk much about playwriting when you were together?
No. Playwrights don't talk about playwriting when they get together. They talk about what everybody else talks about, sex and money and food and attacking critics and things like that.
Would you ever say to Beckett, what do you really mean in that play?
No, certainly not. I'm supposed to know. and if it isn't clear in the play to anybody who's reasonably informed about the nature of the theater, then all the explanation in the world isn't going to do any good. You know, if I like something that somebody does, I'll tell them. I'm not going to hide my enthusiasm from them. But no, playwrights don't sit around together talking about how to write plays.
When it was produced in New York, The Zoo Story, what kind of reaction did it get from audiences and critics?
Every single play of mine on this... It's misunderstood by a lot of people who seem to think that some of them got all rave reviews. They never did. No play of mine has ever gotten any better than mixed reviews. With Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Mr. Chapman with its calculated depravity, and Walter Kerr saying it had a hole in its head. And Zoo Story got some good reviews and some pretty bad ones. But that's been all the way down the line for me. Very interesting.
Within a year after that, the death of Bessie Smith, another one of your plays, was produced in New York off-Broadway. If you, again, you could do a little capsule of that and explain why you didn't want Bessie Smith or her music within the play.
Well, when I read the information, which apparently was not is not quite as true as it, I had been informed then as to how she had died, I was so enraged by the nature of the experience of what I understood, that she had been in an automobile accident and was taken to a hospital and refused admission because it was a white hospital and died on the way to a black hospital. That started the wheels turning in my head quite naturally, and I decided to make a play of that. But as I was writing it, it occurred to me that I was writing much more a play about the moral and intellectual and social and psychological suffocation of the whites in one of the hospitals there than I was about Bessie Smith herself. So she does not appear in the play, though in some productions, when the productions are, can afford it, there's an enormous, wonderful Carl Van Vechten photograph of Bessie Smith, which is blown up on the entire back of the stage, and one of her recordings, both beginning and ending the play.
Did you travel to the South before?
No, I don't think so. I'm not interested in verisimilitude. You know, you make up the South.
It would all be
it's a state of mind, anyway, isn't it?
Well, it's a geographical state as well. Edward Albee is my guest, and he'll be doing a reading this evening at 8 o'clock at the Philadelphia College of Art building on Broad and Pine Streets in their great hall.
I'm going to be reading actually for about 8 of my plays. If I remembered to bring the books with me, I hope I did.
Do you do a lot of readings?
Yeah, sure. That's I enjoy it.
Let's talk about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf,
which
is, I think, probably your most famous play.
Well, certainly it's the one that was made into the best-selling movie, and so it probably is better known than any of the others, sure.
I had read somewhere that you got the title from some graffiti that you'd seen once. Is that true?
Well, if you're a writer, you go around places and you accumulate information and things, and you watch and you listen. I remember once I was in a saloon on 10th Street, Greenwich Village, which is no longer the same saloon. It's changed management and changed its nature since then. But it was on 10th Street between Greenwich Street and Waverly Place. And there was a downstairs bar, as I remember, and people wrote things in chalk on the bar walls and wrote things in soap on the back of the mirror of the bar, the mirror behind the bar. And one night I was in there and I saw a sign behind the bar in soap that said, "Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?" Now, this was 10 years before I started writing plays, but it stuck in my head.
Why did it stick? What?
Just good fortune, I guess.
Why?
I like puns, I suppose.
Why did that work as the title for the play?
Well, I originally called the play The Exorcism or Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And then I got wise to myself, decided that Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was a far better character. And I justified it just by saying that Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf means who's afraid of the big bad wolf, and the big bad wolf being living life without false illusions. So I justified it that way.
Can I ask you again for a capsule?
Wow, that's difficult.
I know.
It concerns a faculty couple, George and Martha, and their late-night visitors after a faculty party, another couple, Nick and Honey. While a great deal goes on in the course of the play, a great deal of yelling and screaming and carrying on, the play concerns itself basically with the exorcism of a non-existent child that Martha and George have created to do battle with themselves with. And the play concerns the exorcism of that child on the eve of its 21st birthday, after which it could no longer be exorcised since it would be an adult.
There is a lot of neurotic arguing within that relationship of
I think it's pretty healthy. You know, when you used the term neurotic before, which was a quote from somebody, I don't think they're neurotic people at all. Neurotic people strike me as people who cannot vent their spleen. And these people get it off their chest quite nicely. And then, my goodness, they've had a relationship of 22, 23 years, and they do love each other very much. It's just that there's an awful lot of extraneous baggage that's got to be gotten rid of. So I've never found them particularly neurotic.
But they don't really get it off their chest, and that no matter how much they vent it, it still remains on their chest, and there's
I think by the end of the play, they've come to a considerable understanding of each other. So it's far more optimistic than pessimistic play.
Did you see at that time a lot of relationships around you that reminded you of the one you created?
I would start going to universities and do readings or lectures. In the first 4 or 5 years after the play came out, every university I went to, some member of the faculty would take me aside and say, oh, you've been here before, haven't you? Because obviously you know Professor so-and-so and his wife, after whom you modeled. And of course, since I'd spent no time at Trinity College when I was there and didn't know anything about faculty people, obviously it was another case of life imitating art.
Are you interested in psychoanalytic theory?
No more than I am in anything else.
Have you read up on that?
Oh, sure. I read a lot.
Have you ever undergone analysis?
No.
So it's just a kind of intellectual interest?
Well, I'm far more... I hope that people will spend far more time going to analysts who will adjust them to themselves rather than try to adjust them to society. I've seen a few creative people I know who have gone to the wrong kind of analyst and have had their creativity taken away from them.
The faculty people who you met who always said, well, surely you must have met blah, 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 because they're just like the couple you created. There are so many couples that never do arrive at that understanding that your couple comes to at the end of the play, who live together on and on, having this incredibly argumentative, bickering relationship. Do you have any idea what keeps people like that together? I figure it's something you must have thought about.
Well, I suppose a certain sadomasochism must, unless it's a Catholic marriage, but even those are beginning to break down now. I don't really know the answer to it. Some people must obviously enjoy it to a certain extent. One faculty couple at a very prestigious ladies' college on the Hudson River near Poughkeepsie did a performance for me one night where they actually did a knockdown and drag-out fight at a party after a reading of mine. I was quite astonished by it. One would have thought they'd rehearsed it. I mean, they did, obviously, in their own lives.
Someone was telling me that in their college drama English class that their teacher had told them to think of the play as George and Martha as being a gay couple having that relationship. Have you heard people talk about that?
Yes, I have. That came about very curiously because there was a man who used to be a movie critic for Newsweek magazine. I forget his name. Doesn't matter. He's gone. Who, when the movie of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf came out, said that as much as he admired the play, he could not bring himself to accept it as an accurate representation of a heterosexual couple, and therefore it could not be. Well, which tells you something about the way the critical mind works from time to time. No, I wrote it, obviously, about two heterosexual couples. If I'd wanted to write it about a couple of gay couples, I would have done it. But it wouldn't work. You know, what do you do about the non-existent child? What do you do about the hysterical pregnancies? What do you do about a whole number of things? It's silly nonsense.
Do you think that...
As opposed to serious nonsense, I guess.
Do you think that American playwrights are more interested in psychological issues than playwrights from other countries are? Because I'm thinking of your work, Tennessee Williams.
I don't think... My work is so varied. Mm-hmm. It goes from absolutely, well, Brechtian naturalism in The Death of Bessie Smith to highly stylized satire in the manner of Ionesco in The American Dream to the most opaque experimentation in some of the other plays. So I don't fit into any of those categories because I'm always moving about the spectrum. But generally speaking, I think American theater is far more influenced by Ibsen and Chekhov than it is by Brecht, by Pirandello, by people of that sort. American education does not give most people the particular glibness of mind and glibness of tongue that some of our European playwrights have. And so our plays don't tend to be quite so obviously intellectually concerned. I'm thinking of people like Stoppard and people of this sort now. I suppose and also American audiences don't tend to like experimental theater anywhere near as much as they like straightforward theater. And since there are an awful lot of playwrights who are cottoning to what an audience wants rather than what an audience should want, sure, you get a lot of that. But I would imagine that if you examine most of the plays that are written almost anywhere, most of them are fairly Ibsenesque and Chekhovian and post-naturalistic. Experimentation is always the outside chance.
Well, I want to get back to that issue of experimentation a little later. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was translated into many different languages and performed around the world.
I've been fortunate that most of my plays have been.
Does that play in particular offer any translation problems, since there's a lot of vernacular ways that people argue, and I don't...
Translation itself presents interesting problems. How do you go about it? Do you do a literal word-for-word translation, or do you do a somewhat freer version, a somewhat freer adaptation, which translates metaphor and translates figurative speech as well? I'm always happier when somebody tries to place the play in the vernacular of the country, in the language in which it's done, without doing disturbance to the locale of the play. When my play is done in Hungary, I like it to be done in Hungarian, not in Hungarian, of course, but in vernacular, but I want it still set in the United States.
Do you run into any censorship questions in other countries?
I have in Eastern Europe from time to time, mostly in the Soviet Union. The censorship problems that one ran into in South Africa, we finally broke down, I'm happy to say. I wouldn't allow my plays to be done there for a very long time because of segregated audiences. And you know, I've been writing plays long enough, 24 years now, 25 years, that at the very beginning of my career, there were still segregated audiences and theaters in the South and the United States. And so I had to put in the leasing contract of all of my plays that they could not be performed in front of segregated audiences.
Were they performed at all then?
Oh, yes. Well, I imagine I lost some performances, but that's tough. Anyway, South Africa, for the longest time, I didn't allow my plays to be performed because the audiences were segregated. But finally, with the death of Bessie Smith, we finally broke down in the commercial theater in South Africa the barrier of segregation. And the audiences were fully integrated in that production. And that was the first time I allowed a play in South Africa. The censorship, every once in a while I hear about a play of mine being performed in a truncated version in some fundamentalist college somewhere, and I raise a fuss about it. You know, if you don't want to do it the way it is, don't do it. But it's mostly in Eastern Europe that you find the thought control most manifest.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the film adaptation with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton?
Well, since I had been promised Betty Davis and James Mason, I wasn't too happy.
Is that true?
Yeah. Well, why would I say it?
I don't know.
Let's see. I'd been promised Pluto and Donald Duck. That's not true. What is true is I'd been promised Betty Davis and James Mason. And so that would have been nice.
So you were disappointed?
Sure. Elizabeth Taylor was, at least 20 years too young for the role? And I didn't think it was as good a movie as it could have been. It was odd that Mike Nichols, who directed it, who'd made his career as a stand-up comic, managed to take a very funny play and make a humorless movie out of it. I guess this was to prove that he was a serious director, or to prove that he was a humorless director anyway.
You think serious people who have a reputation for humor who want to prove that they're serious just...
Become humorless.
Become humorless, right. Burton and Taylor were married at the time. Do you
so
think
they were.
That helped or affected their performance in any way?
It brought a lot of people into the theater, into the movie house, I suppose. That's all right. And I noticed that Burton was very nicely supportive of Elizabeth and made her look very, very good in the course of the film. I just thought the balances were off a little bit. The film of a delicate balance, which practically nobody has ever seen since it was made by the American Film Theater, apparently so nobody would ever see the films they made. That was a much better film with Paul Scofield and Katharine Hepburn. That's a first-rate film, very accurate representation of what I had in mind.
Do you like to work in any way with the director or the screenwriter when one of your works is adapted?
Well, there's never been a screenwriter on either of the two plays of mine that have been made into films. I am credited with a screenplay of A Delicate Balance, but all I did was cut a little bit. Ernest Lehman, the producer, is credited with the screenplay of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, though there was no screenplay. There was merely a rearrangement of my words. Apparently there was a fairly elaborate screenplay which departed considerably from what I had done, but that was never used.
Were you consulted?
Of course not.
Would you have liked to have been?
Yes, certainly. Sure.
The movie Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf introduced your work, though it wasn't exactly your work and you weren't that happy to it, but it introduced your play to millions of people
who don't go
to the theater.
Of
yeah,
that's nice. You know, I would imagine that considering the fact that the movie did play to a lot of people, and it is shown on television somewhere at 4 o'clock in the morning usually, just you know, somewhere all the time, I imagine more people have seen the film of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf than have ever seen performances of any of or all of my plays together or will for the next 100 years. But that tells us more, that tells us less about absolute value than it does about how one medium reaches larger audiences than others.
Well, since you're not that happy with the movie, does it bother you that people who've only seen that film wouldn't truly understand your work? Because you think
they would have a fair appreciation of that particular play, but since that particular play is only one aspect of what I've been up to for the past 24, 25 years, they would get a fairly limited understanding, but better that than nothing, huh?
Do happy relationships interest you for plays?
Personally, yes.
No, for plays, though, as a writer.
Plays, good plays are not made up of people getting along particularly well. There has to be conflict, people in conflict either with each other, themselves, their society, whatever. And plays are not made along. Well, Oedipus Rex is the exception there, isn't it? People getting along too well, perhaps. But generally speaking, that's not the nature of serious drama.
Do you find that people assume that you must know a lot of unhappy relationships
to assume it, yes. I'm merely fairly observant, and I can make things up as well as the next man.
My guest is Edward Albee, and he's in Philadelphia for a reading. This evening he'll be reading excerpts from around 8 of his plays at 8 o'clock tonight at the Philadelphia College of Art at Broad and Pine Streets, and it will be in the Great Hall. You've done several adaptations.
Four, I think, yes.
The most recent one was Lolita,
mm-hmm.
which is an adaptation of the Nabokov play.
Of the Nabokov novel. Yeah.
How did that come about?
It came about because somebody asked me if I'd like to do it, and I jumped at the chance. The production was appalling. It was a disgrace, and it should never have opened, and it closed very, very quickly. The play is very good. The production was a disgrace, and I'm sorry that anybody saw it.
How did you handle the adaptation? Because when I think of Lolita, a lot of that book is descriptive passages that are very, very droll.
One picture's worth 1,000 words, I guess. You just create stage pictures. One of the reasons that I decided to make a stab at making it into a play was I had been so dissatisfied with the film, which, while it has Nabokov down as script writer, did not use his script at any extent. I thought the film misrepresented the book, which I find one of the funniest, saddest, wittiest, most profound novels about America that I've ever read. And I find Nabokov such an extraordinary writer anyway. And so I wanted to be more faithful to his intention. And someday somebody will see that I was.
Was that a musical?
No. Somebody tried to make a musical. Who was the one who wrote Camelot? Alan J. Lerner tried to make a musical of it, which folded in Boston. I can't imagine trying to make a musical out of anything so subtle and complex as Lolita. I think he called it Lolita, My Darling! Exclamation point.
When you see a production not taking shape in the way that you should, will you, as the writer, go in and argue for what you believe should be done with the director?
I will, yes. What happened with Lolita is that I must preface this by saying the play had as in its starring role of Humbert, a movie actor who fancies himself a stage actor as well, by the name of Donald Sutherland. And I have been informed by Donald Sutherland's lawyer that I am not to make any comments about his shenanigans during the rehearsal or performance of Lolita for fear of lawsuit, so I may not talk about how appalling I thought his behavior was. I may not talk about his rewriting of lines, about his refusal to perform the play as I wrote it. I can't talk about his refusal to play the character as complex as it was. I can't discuss any of that What a pity. It would be nice if I could discuss it, but I don't want to be sued. I have never worked with an actor that I found it more unpleasant to work with. The director, I found sycophantic to Mr. Sutherland's demands to a point where not only did I have the star against me, but I had the director against me. And the producer, who had stolen, literally stolen, I believe, I am told, the play away from another producer in, what, a wrestling match or something, I have no idea, decided to produce it on the cheap and as soft porn. And so it was three strikes against me. I could have fought one of them. I could have fought the star. I could have fought the producer or the director. But you get all three lined up against you. There's absolutely nothing you can do. And so I watched it going down the drain. And I just knew that when the reviews came out, I knew who was going to get the blame for everything. Me.
Well, what do you do then? Because it sounds defensive if you try to disassociate yourself.
Well, you can't, you know. You just keep fighting to the last minute and hope that some miracle will happen. You just shrug and go about your business and assume that someday there will be a decent production of it and people will realize that they made the wrong value judgment.
Have you ever attempted to restage it?
Well, it's going to be published very shortly, and then I imagine I will somewhere.
Is it typical for an actor to have in their contract that the playwright can't discuss their impressions of the performance?
No, not at all. It's in the playwright's contract that he has control over everything. But if nobody is paying any attention to you, you don't get those controls. I had an interesting experience in San Francisco a number of years ago related to this whole problem. The Dramatists Guild, which is our union, what we call our union, we have a contract which says that our script is sacrosanct. Nobody may change a word without the author's permission. If anybody changes a word, the words that are changed become the possession of the author. The author has approval of cast and director and the whole thing. But when it comes right down to it, it's fortunate that about 99% of the people you're dealing with are honorable people. Because once I was in San Francisco on my way to Japan, and my back had gone out, and I was in a terrible brace and in great pain. And there was a production of Tiny Alice at the there was some theater out there, some regional theater in San Francisco, a big one, ACT, I think it's called. And I went to a dress rehearsal of it, and I discovered that the director had rewritten parts of the play to clarify, apparently, had moved scenes from one act to another, and I was appalled by this. So I decided to stop the production. And so I called the Dramatists Guild, which said it couldn't do anything about it since it was a regional theater production and therefore it was under Samuel French Leasing Company. And Samuel French said it couldn't do anything about it because for some reason ACT hadn't signed a contract and therefore they had no jurisdiction. Actors' Equity wouldn't do anything about it. Nobody would do anything about it. So I called a press conference.
Really?
Sure.
What was the outcome?
The press conference was that it was highly publicized, and I condemned and disowned the production and said it was a disgrace. And the intelligent reviewers reviewed it on the basis of my comments, and the production got the kind of press treatment it should have gotten.
Do you consider it a mixed blessing when colleges or regional theaters perform your plays?
Oh, I've seen at some colleges some of the best productions of my plays I've ever seen, and at others some of the worst. I imagine most fall in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Edward Albee is my guest. You won two Pulitzer Prizes in 67 and 75 for A Delicate Balance and Seascape.
Mm-hmm.
If you were the Pulitzer committee, are those the two plays you would have chosen to give your Pulitzer
to? Oh, no, I've had many more plays on Broadway than that. That doesn't sound very nice to say, does it? Those are pretty good plays. I don't mind those at all. I would have given it to a couple of others.
Which ones?
Oh, let's see. Well, I don't want to do that because that makes it sound as if I think that whenever I have a play on Broadway, it's better than anybody else's play on Broadway. And whether I think that or not, it's not a matter. The Pulitzer Prizes, like all prizes, they're around. It's nice to win them if they're around. And it's fun to be surprised when you do and fun to be surprised when you don't.
I think you've said that in each of your plays, you're experimenting with something other with language or with the structure of
mm-hmm.
it. Can you describe some of the recent experiments you've undertaken in your recent plays?
It's awfully hard to talk about the kind of experimentation mm-hmm. I do because it is so subtle. Some of my plays are highly allied to musical structure. One of them is in passacaglia form, for example. I'm as much concerned with the sound of language as Beckett is, for example, or Chekhov was. I'm always making experiments in the musical relationships between drama and music. I'm interested in making the theatrical experience, whenever I can, something slightly different than it's ever been before, to make people broaden their expectations of what theater can do. But it's awfully hard to talk specifically about it. You know, it's no fun just to write a story. It's fun to try to change the world a little bit when you do something.
Do you consider any of your work autobiographical?
I've never written specific autobiography. I find that my life tends to be quieter and less interesting than that of my characters. But at the same time, I've never written a character that hasn't been filtered through my own perception. So how do you answer that question?
I suppose like you just did. do you ever get to work closely with the actors? You were talking before about...
Oh, certainly, quite often.
Do actors ever ask you for your interpretation of a character?
Quite often I direct my plays, you see. I'm one of these playwrights who directs. I directed the revival of Virginia Woolf on Broadway in 1976. I directed Seascape on Broadway, which got the Pulitzer. I've directed a number of my plays on Broadway and often around the country. Whenever I'm working with an actor and the actor has a problem and I'm director, I will talk directly with the actor about the problem. If somebody else is directing, I will try to talk through the director rather than undermine the director's authority. Just courtesy.
You were saying before that playwrights don't talk to each other about plays or about what something really means.
Well, we talk about other people's plays, but we don't talk about the art and craft of playwriting very much.
If an actress comes to you and says, I don't really understand, is this supposed to symbolize something? What's at the bottom of this? Will you talk in those terms about it? Has that ever happened?
I have never had an actor ever ask me about symbolism in a play.
Really?
Actors are really so concerned with the three-dimensional truth of whatever they're doing that there's no time for that.
And that pleases you?
Oh, very much, yes.
Does it displease you when someone at a university asks you about the symbolism in a play?
Well, you sort of expect that more at a university than you do in real life.
Will you give line readings to your actors?
I find that I write lines so specifically that line readings determine themselves quite often. I use a lot of punctuation and underlining and stress and indications of how lines are supposed to be read. I'm pretty precise, more precise than most playwrights about how lines are supposed to be spoken. And while I don't want to force any actor to read a line the way I wrote it, I notice that most of them come around to it by just naturally.
Well, what do you think of method acting?
All acting is done to a method. if you're talking about the post-Stanislavski approach of three-dimensionality of character, it's enormously useful, of course. The only trouble with so much of what happened at the Actors Studio when it was having its heyday in New York is it was turning into group therapy sessions rather than acting classes.
Have you ever worked with an actor who used a style of, or approach to acting that you
don't
really conflicted
with? I don't find that much difference. Mm-hmm. It is merely homework. Basically, I don't like any actor that refuses to learn his lines or mumbles after the second week. I don't like any of that. But then again, you don't hire actors who are self-indulgent. But most actors, whether they worked at the Actors Studio or with the Royal Shakespeare Company or whatever, I don't find that much difference if they're intelligent and talented and sensitive.
Your plays are taught in, I think, most theater departments, drama
departments.
Universities around the country. Do you keep up with how your plays are taught? Do you have any opinions of what you've seen or heard about?
Oh, every once in a while I'll go to university and I will be told that somebody has said thus and so, which is a crock, and I try to correct the impression. I'm of two minds about being taught. I guess it's good to be taught, but I suppose it must make people resent you a little bit that they have to study you sometimes.
Oh, because you're the required reading, as opposed to the extracurricular
stuff.
Yeah,
I don't know whether one wants to be required reading or not.
you've been considered iconoclastic, and now you're an established part of the American theater tradition.
The only plays of mine that are established part of the American theater tradition are those which raised fewer stylistic and thematic questions than some of the more difficult ones have. The great majority of my work is still outside of the curriculum.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Edward Albee, who is in Philadelphia today for a reading of some of his plays this evening. He'll be reading excerpts from about 8 plays, and that will be at the Philadelphia College of Art on Broad and Pine Streets in the Great Hall. Who are some of the younger playwrights now whose work you're interested in?
Anybody who's any good, and I hate making lists, because I always leave somebody off by mistake.
How about if I ask you about a couple of names?
If
you'd rather not pass judgment on your fellow playwrights, that would be fine.
I don't think it's fair. They're an awful... Well, let me just generalize for a bit. We probably have far more interesting playwrights under 40 now than we've ever had in this country before, who are doing quite often some very, very good work. Whether we have any giants among them, it's too early to tell.
Do you think that Broadway or off-Broadway has changed much since 1959?
Broadway has become hopeless. It is the home of trash and the middle brow. It's not a respectable place for anybody seriously minded to work in the theater. The economics are just too crippling. And apparently people don't want to be told as much truth about themselves at $45 a ticket than they used to want to be told at $8 a ticket. And you don't find very many very good plays on Broadway. You find infinitely more in the smaller theaters.
Do you think that Broadway, off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway have expanded since you started?
Oh, off-off-Broadway. Goodness, yeah. Yes. That's where the great majority of the serious work is done. Do you know, here's a playwright who's developed something of a reputation over the past 12 years, I guess, Sam Shepard. Sam has never had a play on Broadway.
But his work's known around the country.
Of course, sure, because of regional theaters, college theaters, and off-off-Broadway, of course.
Yeah, how does the growth of regional theater affect playwrights like you who live in New York? Because New York has always had the theater, and regional theater...
Well, we've always thought of off-off-Broadway as being our own regional theater, mm-hmm. our own special regional theater. What the regional theaters are doing are they're producing the great majority of the serious work by younger American playwrights. And thank God, because somebody has to produce it. And as a result of this, there's more of an outlet for young playwrights to get their work performed by professionals in the regional theaters than there ever was in New York City. But a sad thing has started entering this at the same time. The Broadway producers are using the regional theaters as a kind of tryout house for what is tolerable on Broadway. And a number of the managements of a number of the regional theaters around the country are no longer producing the quality of play they used to produce. They're trying to produce the kind of middle-brow play that they think the Broadway producer will pick up because they share a great deal in the profits and the money from this. And so a number of the regional theaters have corrupted their standards as a result of this, which is too bad.
In the hopes of being successful eventually on Broadway.
That's right, yeah.
Do you go to theater a lot?
Oh, sure. Far more than I want to.
Well, then why do you go?
Because I'm probably the most enthusiastic member of any theater audience. I go there expecting enlightenment and a miracle. And every once in a while it happens, and it's wonderful when it does.
Do you get really annoyed when it doesn't, when you're waiting patiently or impatiently through several long acts?
There are some times when I wish it wouldn't be so noticeable if I walked out. But sometimes you can't, because that's going to be insulting to a playwright, so you don't, you stay. And quite often I want to leave. I found that my level of tolerance for the meretricious or the mediocre is far less now than it used to be.
Do you see any trends in, I know you've said middle brow, but more specifically, any trends in the kinds of plays being produced now that seem to get audiences and achieve success?
Aside from your manufactured musicals, which are generally speaking as cynical as General Motors and the rest of the car companies in this country, it is a particular kind of middle browism which passes for intellectualism and gives people the feeling that they're having an experience when they're really not. Again, I don't want to name those plays. They know who they are.
There's been quite a trend of one-person plays where one person takes on the role of a great figure in history.
It's cheaper.
What do you think of those dramatically? What do you think of them as theater?
Well, when Beckett writes a one-character play like Crap's Last Tape, it's a masterpiece. when somebody else puts together an impersonation of a historical figure, it can be dross. Again, it depends completely on the person. Not too many of your more serious playwrights have written one-character plays with actors or actresses impersonating historical figures. It's a gimmick, basically.
Do you ever read plays? And do you feel that you can really judge a play from reading
it? Oh, yes. Goodness. A play is literature. Whenever I'm a judge on a number of play contests every year, and I'm very specific. I don't want to judge the contest unless I have either seen and read all of the plays or merely read all of the plays. I would not judge any play merely having seen it.
Really?
No.
Because it might be a bad production.
That's right. Or a distorting production, a worse production. I think I can usually see the play through the production. But a play is literature, and it exists on the page. A good play is not proved on the stage, is not rather improved on the stage. It's proved. And I rather read them, because I can see a production of a play in my head and in my ear when I read it. And I know exactly the way the play truly is on stage.
Would you be interested in writing for television?
Is there such a thing?
Well, with public television now, they've produced
Yeah,
some,
public television, I wish it had enough money to ask playwrights to write for, but apparently it doesn't. Why don't we have a use tax on television sets in this country, the way they do in Britain? You know about that?
Mm-hmm.
$25 use tax per year on every television set. You know how much that would bring in this country for public television? Over $2 billion a year. Isn't that extraordinary?
We talk about that during our fundraisers all the time.
Why can't we get our government to do something about that? $25 a year for a television set. $2 billion for public television and public radio. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
I wouldn't complain, believe me.
Lordy.
What about films? Would you want to do more work in
There's
film?
There's only one trouble writing for film. You see, you get spoiled when you're a playwright. Because when you're a playwright, you're not an employee. You lease your play. When you write films, you are hired to write a screenplay, and anybody can change anything you want. And I've gotten spoiled. I like to lease my work, and I like to make my own mistakes, and I don't like to have my work improved or destroyed by other people. And when you write for the theater, that's generally true. Also, I'm sort of a word man. I love the sound of language, and words, generally speaking, get in the way of film.
I know that you feel a good deal of your work has been misinterpreted by critics, and you've said that playwrights make the best critics. Do you still stand by that?
And oh, certainly.
Have you ever written criticism?
I keep wanting to. I keep thinking, wouldn't it be interesting if I were a drama critic? Finally, somebody would be getting the opinion of somebody who knows something about the theater from the inside. Wouldn't it be interesting? Because I found some of our most interesting drama critics in this country have been professional theater people, like Harold Clurman, for example. And you take in the other fields. Virgil Thompson, the composer, was our best music critic. And Andrew Porter, who writes for The New Yorker now, our best music critic, a trained musician. More people who are practitioners of the art should be critics, without question.
Do you have any new plays that will be produced in the near future?
I have two plays. Well, I wrote a shortly under an hour-long play called Finding the Sun, S-U-N, about 6 or 8 months ago. It was commissioned by a university in the Middle West. And I'm finishing up another slightly under an hour, one-act play, which has been commissioned by University of California at Irvine. And the two of them will be performed together out at Irvine in May, and I would suspect they'll be performed at a good off-Broadway theater sometime next season.
You're going to be reading this evening in Philadelphia from about 8 of your plays.
Mm-hmm. Chronologically, I think, which is only fair.
Do you enjoy performance? Have you ever tried acting or considered
it? I gave up acting when I got thrown out of college when I was 19. But I acted. I do a good reading. I know that. Because I can give an audience a sense of how I heard it when I wrote it. And I enjoy doing it. I'm fairly hedonistic. If I didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't do it.
Which plays will you be reading from, do you know?
Zoo Story, A Delicate Balance, Box, Seascape, All Over, Counting the Ways, and Finding the Sun.
How do you handle the different characters, do you?
Come and find out.
Okay. It's really been great to have you here. I want to thank you a whole lot
for
doing the
You've made it fun. You've made it nice.
Well, I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Edward Albee has been my guest, and he will be reading from about 8 of his plays this evening at the Philadelphia College of Art, and that's at Broad and Pine Streets in their room called the Great Hall. It's at 8 o'clock, and he's also holding playwriting and directing workshops tomorrow, but I should inform you that those are already filled. However, this evening still has available seats. That's at 8 o'clock tonight at the Broad and Pine Street Philadelphia College of Art in the Great Hall. It's 5 minutes to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening Monday afternoon on Fresh Air and Sunday on the Best of Fresh Air after this report from Shadow Traffic.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. For motorists heading home on the Schuylkill Expressway westbound, some slow going around Vera Avenue due to a disabled tractor-trailer blocking the right lane. Some slow going on the eastbound side from approaching Vine in through south. A two-alarm fire in Lower Moreland has closed Huntington Pike between Byberry Road and Papermill Road. Some local detours around the area. Southbound I-95 slowing going down to the airport area. From the upstroke of the Girard Point Bridge down onto the Platte Detour Road at Island. Also westbound 291 slowing heading out towards Bartram Avenue. Northbound I-95 slows for a quarter mile approaching the Ray Street merger, and again around Aramingo Avenue and the Betsy Ross Bridge. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is Jim Battalese.
That's Shadow Traffic Report, funded with a grant from Wilkie Buick Subaru. Monday afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by the new fire commissioner of Philadelphia at 3:40. Julie Burstein reports on the arts. At 4 o'clock, I'll speak with Joseph Mendelevich, who was a prisoner in a Soviet prison camp for a little over a decade. He was imprisoned after trying to take a jet to Israel, where he wanted to live, to kind of hijack this jet. He now lives in Israel. He was exiled from the Soviet Union. He visited Philadelphia just a few days ago. At about 4:30, we'll hear from Fred Kaplan, who is an expert on nuclear arms race and the author of the book The Wizards of Armageddon. This Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, we'll hear from two analysts of the American economy who completely disagree with each other. We'll hear from Louis Rukeyser, host of Wall Street Week on public television, who's an enthusiastic promoter of the American capitalist system, and Michael Harrington, who is a democratic socialist and author of the book The Other America. He's now the chair of the Democratic Socialists of America. So that's this Sunday at 2 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air. I hope you can be listening. John Knapp was the technical director for today's show. Assistance was contributed by Jeff Foreman. Maeve McGoran is the associate producer of the program, Danny Miller the co-producer. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and hope you have a great weekend. Thank you. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Susan Stamberg.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.